Welcome to WisePod. Andalusia Farm, the home of Flannery O'Connor, is pleased to connect you with all manner of business happening here. As Flannery said, you can get to Milledgeville by bus and buzzard. And now, via WisePod. Enjoy.
Well, hello everyone. Welcome to Andalusia Farm's February 4 and the opening of the exhibition covering Flannery, Book Design and Visual Narrative. Thank you for coming out today, as I know there is fierce competition coming from a certain game featuring a trivial, contemptible obelid, as William Faulkner would say. My name is Elizabeth Wiley, and I have the privilege of serving as executive director of a nonprofit that owns and manages the farm that served as inspiration and a place of respite for one of the 20th century's greatest writers, and one whose work still resonates with relevancy. The 2017 February 4 series is focusing on Flannery's second novel, The Violent Bear It Away, every Sunday this month. You can learn more about the program on our cards, which are out front, and if you aren't able to attend, each of the presentations is podcast, hence our wonderful technician here. If you aren't receiving our direct mails or emails, please be sure to add your information at the sign-in sheet out front. You'll receive, I'm told they're coveted, direct mails and our quarterly e-news down on the farm, as well as updates about programs and events such as our every third Thursday, Thurstalusia open mic, which by popular request we're doing again. April through September, so the farm is open till sunset every third Thursday, April through September, and we'll have an open mic and maybe more free Wise Blood IPA. We also have a date for our Bluegrass Festival, which is October 28th, so mark your calendar for that. Before I introduce today's presenters and the duo behind the exhibition, I want to acknowledge support for the program from the Flannery O'Connor Review at Georgia College and the Wyoming Council for the Arts. Also, Mark Sellers, graduate student in creative writing at Georgia College, contributed a fascinating essay on Flannery's take on book design, and you can see that here. Also, a shout out to April Moon Carlson and the rest of the farm staff who create good experiences for our visitors here. Also want to let you know that after the presentation there will be a Q&A and then a demonstration on the front porch and a reception with refreshments. Now on to today's presenters who will share the inside story and answer all your burning questions on their collaboration that resulted in new cover designs for 5 reissues of Flannery's books. June Glasson is an artist and designer who lives in Laramie, Wyoming. Her work has been exhibited at museums and galleries internationally. It's also been published in a wide array of print and online media. Paris Review, Wall Street Journal, Bomb, Domino, and People. She holds a BFA from Cornell and has received a variety of commissions from store display, book cover, product design, movie sets, and site-specific installations. A real Renaissance woman. Charlotte Strick is a designer and art director and principal at Strick & Williams, New York City-based boutique multidisciplinary design firm focused on the arts, education, publishing, nonprofits, and everything in between. Her work has been featured in many books about cover design, and she was the recipient of the coveted Silver Cube from the Art Directors Club. Her writings on art and design have been published in the Paris Review, the Atlantic, and the Huffington Post. Charlotte is a graduate of Parsons School of Design and lives in New York City. Please join me in welcoming June and Charlotte.
Hi there, everyone. Thank you for coming out today.
We want to thank Elizabeth for the incredible invitation and the warm welcome we received from everyone here at the farm. This is a real treat, and June and I have been working on this project since, I guess, 2013, and it just keeps giving back. As Elizabeth explained, I'm a graphic designer by training, and I worked for 14 years at Farrar, Straus & Drew, which was Flannery's publisher. It's commonly known as FSG, and I worked my way up from grunt designer to art director of the paperback line there. And that is how I came to be charged with redesigning all these incredible covers. I met June in a really serendipitous way. I was at the doctor's office flipping through an old magazine, Domino, which Elizabeth mentioned earlier, and waiting my turn, and discovered an article about affordable portraiture. And I loved June's work the best of all the artists who were featured, and I decided to reach out to her to see if she would make a portrait of my husband for a holiday gift. And we met at Barnes & Noble and we did the trade and got on well and bid each other farewell. And then I sort of kept up with her because my job at FSG required that I am always on the lookout for artists whose work moves me. And you never know when you're going to need a certain person to solve a certain problem. So June and I think I reached out to you for the Paris Review, mm-hmm. I think first, where I'm also the art editor and designer. And June ended up illustrating a longer form piece for us there. And it was such a great collaboration that we just kept in touch. And then when the Flannery project came along or something, I just thought, I think June might be the right artist for this project.
And it was really exciting when I got that email too. She emailed me. She said, I'm working on maybe a series of books, at least one book for the author. Do you know her, Flannery O'Connor? And I was like, yes. My partner is a writer. I ran out of the room and told him. So I was so thrilled when Charlotte reached out to me about this project. So it's been a very collaborative process for both of us.
Yeah. And sometimes you just get lucky when you're a creative person to find a partner who you're not fighting with, but you're actually bringing more to the project. So we've been really lucky. That because FSG is, first person here, is such an important, the Three Fish, American book publisher there. Flannery is one of, I think, 26 National Book Award winners. She won posthumously in 1972, 8 years after her death. And there, we weren't actually trying to repackage the books for any particular anniversary. One of the great tasks of art director of the paperback line is there's a lot of pressure. You know that there are lots of fans out there who are expecting the best from you. So you want to make them as happy as possible. And then there's always the opportunity with repackaging to reach a whole new audience. So this cover from 1967 by Milton Glaser, who you guys might know from his I Love New York logo, among many other things. This one's, of course, been reappropriated by many. He used to do quite a few book jackets, and in 67, he created this Wise Blood cover. And the editor at FSG, where I was working with, said, God, I love this cover. Maybe we should just reissue this one. And so that's how I started thinking about June, because there was a sort of sooty, inky quality about the illustration that I thought, I know June loves to work with inks. I bet she could think about the other covers in the series in a similar way. So that's where we started with our club. And then about a week later, the same editor appeared in my office and he said, I think this cover is just so well loved. Maybe we should consider using that as a jumping off point. And the best thing you can do as a book jacket designer, of course, is to read the manuscript. But if the books have already been out for years and years, to also look back and see what other people have done, because some people have solved that problem before and some people may have done it in a way that might inspire you. So I sent this to June and we started talking about how it could be recreated in black and white and maybe a flood of color like this, maybe peacock blue or something. And then June, you can
jump in. Yeah. So, we talked about the idea of keeping with the circular format of the peacock and using kind of framework around the outside of the text. So I knew that I'd be creating an illustration or a painting. So the initial kind of first two sketches I sent her were using a water-based medium called Quink. So they were kind of black and white. And as soon as I kind of, I sent her a few of these images, and right away she sent me feedback and said, well, hey, can you, is there a possibility to maybe loosen up a little bit? And then we started to talk about the idea of introducing some color. So instead of having the color at the back of the jet, behind the text and the images, actually incorporating it into the framework, using the kind of quinks I do. So as soon as we started to go in that direction, I think intuitively we both kind of felt we liked where it was going. So I just kept going. And, when I worked on each of these covers, I'd send Charlotte 5 or 6 sketches. So here's a kind of pared down examples of the actual
like
sketches.
20 or 40.
So I tend to
this
work.
This is just a sample.
These are just samples. So as an artist, when I kind of work through this kind of a process, it is very process oriented. I do, you know, 5, 6, and I only even center the ones that are decent. So I made a lot of these covers. And, you know, for this first initial one, we had to figure out the style and the coloring and the design and the layout. And this is the first time that I'd really been working. I'd done other kind of design or freelance work, but it was the first time I was really working on a book cover. So it was kind of a new experience for me, but Charlotte was very patient. And what Charlotte does is magical. She takes sometimes a few of the different illustrations I've done and kind of weaves them together.
So I think one of the great things about being an art director is to think about how you can package something that's been packaged many, many times and do it in a new way. And there's really a leap of faith when you hire an illustrator to work with, because you know you're going to have to work with them pretty intimately, and your budget's small. You don't want it to go sour, because if it does, there'll be really no money left. And you'll probably have to solve it on your own in some way. So approaching June, as soon as I heard that she was a Flannery fan, I knew that we chose it right.
So when we started discussing Wise Blood, we went back to the original Milton cover. And so I knew that I wanted to try and do a portrait somewhat in his style, but using a little bit of my own artistic flair. And I really wanted to concentrate on, you know, because I didn't have a portrait I was working from, I was kind of being inspired by the cover. So I knew I wanted to do a man, but I didn't want his features to be too specific, and the glasses were really an element that we thought would be interesting to emphasize. So the way I worked with the water-based inks, but I started introducing different colors as a way of playing around with that. So these are a few examples. Some of them got really creepy looking. And some of these are Charlotte, she'd be like, they're a little too dark.
Or very alien.
Yeah. But here I'm using the Quink Indian inks that I'm dropping in. I'm just kind of, I'm being very, for me, very, very loose. And I'm doing these very quickly. But we got a lot of different results. We didn't end up using all of them, but they're kind of fun to show. And you can see more examples on the wall, too, behind me. So here I gave up on the glasses, and actually I'm just trying to create these spots of vision.
A flare
of eyes. And this is one with a bowler hat. And actually, this is one of my favorites, I think, out of it. But we kind of lost the formatting that we had with the peacock and the other ones. So then we were trying to make sure it tied in with the other covers. So I remember, when they circle back to Milton's cover and really actually kind of use that face a little bit and use my coloration and use my kind of hand. So here you can see it kind of echoes the Milton cover. It's still a little like psychedelic, so it pays kind of a little homage to that period and that kind of graphic design, but updates it. And then in the end, I think what Charlotte ended up doing is actually piecing, maybe you want to say, together a few of these.
Yeah. I had a jacket meeting in the morning. I had to solve this by 9 a.m. and I stayed really late at work and ate my dinner at my desk and thought, how am I going to get this one done? It has to be done. We've been working on it for so long, and I was working on these in-between projects. And I had them all. So I just started layering them in Photoshop and creating different transparencies and... So this face is actually, I think, probably three of the faces on the wall. The one sort of highest on the wall is the most, you can really see the lips in there from that one. And then just pushing and pulling in Photoshop, something called levels, which gives you contrast, and bringing in my own layers of color. And suddenly he just started emerging, which was really exciting. And then bringing the type in, the way that Milton had too, but of course using June's handwriting, which really felt, they really felt like all of a sudden it belonged. And it's the only cover where the frame is actually filled in, as opposed, but we still retained the white outer border. It ended up working out really well. I was very proud of this one.
And it's very, it shows how collaborative the process is, because I just sent her so much stuff. And then it's about kind of editing it back down and really being careful and curating on certain things. And then her layering. Did you have a question?
I do. Yeah. At one point, did you decide to do the background off-white, that cream color? That seems like it's consistent.
It is consistent.
So whose decision was that, and how was it made?
That is a very good question. It would have been my decision, and I think I just wanted the work to feel painterly, and stark white felt wrong. These books were written at a different time, but I also wanted them to feel Mormon contemporary, so it was kind of a marriage of those two ideas. And they needed to feel, it still needed to feel like June's work, although as you can see, she worked on a white sheet. But I think that cream often reminds us, without even thinking about it, that you're working with artist paper. And so even though there's no texture that we included, it gave all the work a little bit of light behind the washes, too, that wouldn't have been there. But June and I were actually just talking this morning about her oil paintings and how she'll do a wash and then start building on top of it. So in a way, it was a digital version of that.
Yeah. And I think, like, the books, if you see them out in the little shop as objects, they really do read like kind of artist books, like a sketchbook. Like, there's, for a book, it seems it has a little bit of a different life to it almost because of that. And it's a choice I loved, like, as soon as I, like, saw it in person. Because if you see the books, the art wraps around the back, there's a little portrait, there's some handwritten text too, so it's a very comprehensive envelope for the book.
Sweet turn.
Oh, wow.
It's an old Mystery and Manners cover. We've included this whole series in here. These were done around the time, just before I started at FSG, so they're probably about 16 years old, this series, done by a designer who was on staff before me.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting in working on these covers together is that, you know, we're working with existing covers, and so in some ways I feel like we're almost like jazz artists, that we're being inspired by work that's already been created and fiction, and then riffing off of it in our own style as a team. So with this one, we jumped in with a very similar motif. And I used, again, the inks, the Quink, and I used a little bit more gouache in here to get kind of the brighter peach colors. And at this point, you know, we'd done a few covers, so I was feeling very loose, and I kind of knew what direction we were at least going. So, you know, this one we ended up doing rather quickly, and I just whipped out some peaches.
Like, don't forget a place for type.
Yeah, and she'd be like, June. So as you can see, some of my this would be my page of drawings and paintings. So I'm just kind of drawing all over the page and kind of working quickly and loosely and trying to think visually how to actually incorporate the text that I needed to be there.
Why the peach, not an apple? That's a good question.
It's funny that
as a symbol of temptation. I mean, I know the church of people, right?
Garden of Eden, serpent and peach.
Yeah.
I think maybe she was riffing off of that
as an idea.
So here we're, you know, trying to figure out how do we keep the circular oval composition of the others.
Mm-hmm. Like that one just felt too open to me. So this is pretty much where we ended up. And then when I got it, I thought, gosh, you know, I felt like we had a lot of warm tones going on in all the covers. So maybe we needed to have another blue to balance out. So with Everything Rises. So
yeah.
I just changed it up the saturation on the peach. Kept
up, right?
Yeah, I gave the snake eyes. He didn't have eyes. I thought that might be eyes on a cover always make a big difference, even if it's a snake. And I kept the tongue red. And what's it?
And then I read the text. I think like once she had a composition, sometimes I'd go back and then read the text. So this one was quite easy. I feel like
this one came pretty quick to me.
Why was this one so much easier? Because you had worked together before?
We had been working together for about a year at that point. And at that point we felt pretty confident about the frame, and we'd already gotten some approved with the publisher. We also just really loved this idea of the snake and the peach as a, I don't know, they just felt like they worked really well. It was a late addition to the group. This one wasn't going to be repackaged. The others were so well received that they said, okay, you can do this one too. And we thought we'd end with the Violet Baird Way, although Mystery Manners was officially the last one we did in the group, but since this is our theme for February, this one was actually potentially the hardest one. It just went on and on.
So this one, I think we were both kind of drawn to this cover and the color because it tied back into the Milton. So when we kind of started talking about doing this cover, we definitely were like, let's see if we can use some of those kind of hot pinks and reds in it.
And June uses a lot of those colors in her artwork anyway, so it's just a really comfortable place for her.
Was that that wasn't that Time Life book, by any chance, this one?
This last one? You know,
it's,
I don't know.
It's blurry.
I don't think so. This is an FSG.
It's FSG.
It is FSG for sure. Yeah, it's Noonday, which was one of their imprints that doesn't exist anymore.
It's a more recent one, right?
More recent, yeah. This is the one from about 16 years ago.
So once again, we had these kind of book covers and the work itself to work off. So I think we started with maybe thinking about incorporating this kind of the idea of the burning tree as our motif and trying to use as the framework. So I started sending her sketches of trees. But I think we were a little concerned because none of the others bled off the edge, that maybe this was doing that too much. Mm-hmm. So I tried kind of approaching it in a different way. As I said, I was trying to incorporate those really hot pinks and reds. And here, you know, I believe in the violent buried away, the cornfields go right up to the house, right? I think they're planted really close. So here I was kind of thinking about those corn stalks and using that coloration. And here I'm playing around again with the burning tree, but really trying to create a literal framework out of it. And then here, sort of loosen up a little bit. And here I'm just using flames. You know, we've got the cross, we've got the shovel.
It's right there on the wall.
Or in the pile. I probably did about 20 of these. So just kind of pushing through and trying different ways to, you know, a lot of these are really solid designs, but it's also tying it back into the other covers so that they all tell a story together and they connect visually to the reader and the public.
Did you use the same mediums as your others?
Yeah, so as soon as we kind of hit on the first two, then I knew I was going to be sticking with that kind of medium, that style, and trying to approach them all in the same way. Which was nice because it's kind of, you almost get like a rhythm to it. I do some more, we send it back, and none of them were quite working.
Jelly with a type, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then we got really excited about this.
So I was starting to think about this idea of guns, and the problem was, I guess it was more of a rifle in the story.
So while a handgun fit really nicely right here, it wasn't quite, when I brought it to the meeting, I got called out on it. So that's okay.
I think imaginatively I just started making the leap, and I was like, oh my god, these guns would be great, because I found, like, they were old pistols I found online, and then of course I just was jumping there and I forgot that it wasn't actually a handgun.
Yeah, and I just like, I fell in love with the way that June handled that metal. I mean, it's just so beautiful. Just incredible.
Yeah, and this is the all painted in what I use as a medium called Quink. It's a water-based ink that's patented by Parker, and it's made for calligraphy pens. And I use it in a lot of my portraits, and what I love about it is black ink, but the pigments in it break down when you wash it out to blues and oranges that really, in some ways, reference old daguerreotypes and old photographs, and it's always a little unsure of what's going to happen. So even though this is a black ink, when I wash it out, you get all these kind of different accidents.
All the modeling, yeah.
So we both were really excited about these, but they weren't quite working.
I brought it to the meeting. I remember running upstairs with it to show that, look, we did it, we solved it. And he wasn't as excited. He said, I just want to live with it for a few days. And he kept it on its shelf. And it really, the gun issue, the inaccuracy of the guns just weren't ringing true. Yeah. So sometimes you have to put your favorites back in the drawer. So we did. And then I went back to June and asked her, what could we do?
Yeah.
With a shotgun. And so she created a similar, and then, again, the flames were so great here because they really, again, feel like our tail feathers, the water dripping off those angry crows. And then June was doing a lot of, you'll see in the other room, lots of playing around with sort of doily, like lace shapes that she introduced in this particular one at the bottom for the frame.
There's so many references to fire in that book that it felt like a very direct way to connect to the book.
And this one actually get that arc at the top, which kind of closes in things the way that I wanted the illustration to do, where some of the others just went straight up with the smoke. So this was, it gave us a more complete shape. Mm-hmm. And so that's how they look on your bookshelf.
And it's they feel very cohesive. I think to create one book's great, but to be able to create five is a really, it's an unusual thing, I feel like, as a probably book designer or an artist, to be able to do a long project like this.
Yeah, it's special, yeah, for sure. For all sorts of reasons. So then we got a call from Snapchat asking if we would create a cover for A Good Man Is Hard to Find. And we thought, hey, we got a piece of work for you.
And so for people who don't know who Snapchat So maybe people might not know what it is.
It's moving in and going too fast.
But yeah, basically it's an online platform where you can post things and then it disappears. But they were trying to, when they reached out to us, they wanted to introduce a younger demographic to Flannery. But yeah, so it was a great opportunity to take what we've done, what, you know, some of Flannery's writing, and get it to an audience that maybe hadn't, you know, maybe in college they'd read her, but a lot of them maybe hadn't, so.
And then we got to pull out the guns
again. Yeah, we got to use the guns.
So that was great. So I just asked June to do the type, and I was able to fit it back in. And again, it had to be a different format because it had to fit on your cell phone, which is not the same dimensions as a phone cover.
So when did you guys do this?
Last year. Last year. And like June said, it was on for, you know, 2 minutes. And it was gone.
And it was like the feature of the day.
We're happy to bring it to you. So that was exciting. And then, as many of you may know, the U.S. Post Office released a Flannery O'Connor stamp, and it was received with pretty mixed reviews, and some angry fans said that it reminded them of Betty Crocker, and it was not the Flannery that they, they were not pleased. So FSG, I was then out on my own, I started my own design studio, and I got a great email. At this point, I'm thinking, okay, Flannery's behind me. I'm looking forward to this talk. But FSG said, well, what would you guys have done? What would you have done for a fantasy stamp? So I constructed the 6 stamps out of all the work that June and I had made, and that was really satisfying and fun to do. And people keep asking where they can buy
that
the stamps.
That was never.
No. But June and I have made an art print out of it that is for sale.
So you can buy the print of stamps.
You
but
can buy
the USPS.
Print, but you can't
not using them yet.
You can't put it on your envelope.
No, we are open to it if anyone works for the Postal Service.
Print our stamps. We are. We got a lot of good press on it.
Instead of a forever stamp, it's a never stamp.
I like it. And then I did cut them up to see what they might look like. So that's just me being crazy.
Were really
crazy.
I'll have to study.
Where do we buy those?
The prints. So we are actually talking to the farm about, we brought some prints with us, and I think they're going to be selling them in the near future. So not today, but hopefully.
Not the stamps. We have prints of the covers with us.
Okay. But there's a print of, there'll be a print of this too. But yeah, I mean, I think for both Charlotte and I, like, this was an amazing experience, like, work experience. I mean, working with Flannery's work was amazing, so it was, I don't know, it was pretty wonderful.
Yeah. But thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank
you.
We thank Flannery for having us, giving us an excuse to collaborate.
And for bringing us down here to,
yes,
to talk listening and share our collaborative process. But we'd be happy to answer any questions you guys have about what we do or the work.
This may be elementary or out of line, but how much is digital and how much is actually print and paper?
That's a really fair question.
Yeah.
And maybe showing, like, taking it to the wall might be it.
Yeah, this is probably a good place to start. I mean, so everything that... All the original art is June's brush. And she sent me digital scans from Wyoming. I work in New York. So I got all of this work as high-res scans from her studio. And then none of them alone felt tight enough for the jacket. I appreciated them as artwork, but again, it's that fine line between commercial art and fine art. And so it was then that I you can see, I forgot which one we found. So this is the head, right here. And this guy, let's see, I think it's this one up here, is the legs. And then...
the one below is the body, maybe?
You can sort of see the different leaves.
Yeah.
So I piece them together, and then because June uses this bright medium, there is so much layering in the artwork. So if you push in Photoshop your levels and hue and saturation, it's not a flat color that you're getting. It actually, you know, what was once deep greens and blacks all of a sudden might pick up some yellows. Mm-hmm. And so then it started to transform. And then you can see that none of June's paintings actually include this blue for the tail feathers. But the shapes are all there. So those are her original brushes, but my decision to try to bring us back to the Skaggs 1971 cover, which people recognize as the Complete Stories. And it's, as a jacket designer who really appreciates the designers who came before her, I love being able to pay homage to the people whose work has meant a lot to the public. So it was fun to kind of collaborate with him, even though of course he wasn't sitting next to me at the desk. Yeah, yeah.
And you're definitely not, she's not like taking a picture I did and just like putting it around some text. Like I feel like, as you can tell from what she's, the process she's describing, is she's really cutting and pasting, and we're collaborating.
It's a collage.
Like, yeah, like it's not my work and it's not her work. Like this exists, we made it together.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of times, and you may have just answered my question, but just to be sure. You mentioned a couple of times that certain designs didn't strike you as being tight enough to meet your standard. What constitutes a tight design?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. That's all about balance, right? I mean, I don't know if you're a fine artist or a graphic artist.
No.
But I think there's just a, you just kind of,
you know
it's about color balance, it's about, is the type readable, script type is can be tricky, a lot of people in editorial and marketing will say, we can't read that S. No one will know what that's an S.
I remember there's like one letter she kept having me rewrite. I wrote Flannery's name when we were doing the first cover, like probably like 50 or 100 times. Yeah. And I'd try and get looser, and she'd be like, no, not too loose. And I have to pull it back. And then at some point she'd be like, okay, that's perfect, but the S is off. You know, just like, give me a couple more S's.
So then that's balanced.
Just cut the S in and put it into the rest of the text.
Yeah, and then of course in Photoshop I can push and pull like a potter, you know.
Yeah.
But it's important to me if I'm working with an artist that I honor them as well, and there's integrity in our agreeing to work together. So yeah.
But genesis of creating those covers is actually a fascinating part of this discussion.
Oh good.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Elizabeth was hoping.
Yeah, and I think it's probably pretty. I don't know if it's unusual, but I feel like. I've only had so many work relationships that are like this, where it's so collaborative. Because usually people are so busy, and we had a pretty big open deadline with this too, which sometimes when you do a book cover, you have like 4 weeks to turn around. So you don't have this kind of leisure of like back and forth and adjust and this. Like we had a lot of time to do it too, which I think helped make the covers as great as they are, but also made it a really fun and less stressful in some ways.
Yes, I think that's true. It gave us some time to like an artist would hope to step back in your studio, walk away from it for a little while,
and
come back.
Or left and right.
Yeah.
You mentioned having so much time. It sounds also like you had mentioned you had spent enough time, it was time to make a decision at some point.
Yeah.
Well, we did. I had deadlines I had to make.
Yeah.
But they weren't.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And you're always in a limited budget, too. So
you
got to spend
the discussion of produce the final work.
Yeah. I owe June mountains of money just for the paper.
We had a pile this big that we brought here, and then in my studio I have a pile this big.
That's why I urged her to sell everything on these walls.
I don't know who's first.
Are these the originals, or what you consider to be the original?
Artist proof.
They are. These are the sketches from my studio. That's how they are. You'll see some of the corners, or you know, you'll see imperfections in them, and you'll see pencil marks. And when we talked originally with Elizabeth about the idea and the concept behind this show, is that it's almost as if you were walking into my studio, and like Charlotte had come to visit, and we were laying out the work that we've been working on the last year. So there are pencil marks. You can kind of see where I sketched in the text. There's messy ink drops. So it's not cleaned up. It's the work I made. And you know, I erased a few smudges, but other than that, that's the work.
And there are no copies of any of this.
Yeah, there are no copies of any of this.
These are
originals.
My question may be too technical, the answer may be too boring for everyone else, but why inks versus watercolor versus dyes? Because there's this thing called Martin dyes that everyone used to use for a while. You know?
Have you played with those
things? I haven't really played with Martin dyes.
Martin dyes.
And I think, as an artist, a lot of the mediums I use are things that I think have just come across from other artists or people have lent to me. So the Quig is something I just stumbled upon when I was looking for a black ink, and I've been using it for, I think, 8 to 10 years now, and I love it. I do, so these do use Quink. They do use some watercolor. They use some Higgins inks. And like I said, I think there's maybe a tiny bit of gouache in some of them. So I'm using a few different water-based mediums. And it's not that I meant to exclude anything. It's just kind of what the resources I had at hand and stuff I've probably just gotten comfortable with in my studio. So I don't, does that answer your question? But I will probably look into those inks. Because
I don't even know if I can make them anymore. When I was an illustration student, right, you know, back in the 70s, and I remember Jerry Contreras was always talking about Martin dyes, like that's all they used. Very saturated, in the bottle like ink.
Yeah.
And it was called Martin dyes.
It's probably around, but I mean, I studied sculpture, so so I didn't take any illustration classes, and I only took one or two painting classes at university. So, like I said, most of the materials came from my friends who were doing other stuff, or someone gave me some watercolors. And then, you know, then you start to pick something up when you go to the art store, but it's kind of arbitrary. Mm-hmm. But I'll look into it, though. I'd be interested.
What have you been told by Pereira Strauss Giroux about the life cycle, how long this will last, and what the next, where the next
where they
set of colors will come from? You have rights?
With rights. Oh gosh, no. You know, when I worked
literal shelf life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, book publishers make decisions about their backlist based on interest. You know, sometimes I repackaged the Christopher Isherwood backlist while I was there, and the Bernard Malamud backlist. So sometimes with Malamud, it was his 100th birthday, so we thought, okay, it's time. Those were using covers that had been on those books since I think the 70s, and they were artworks by the author's lover and longtime boyfriend, and he was the estate holder. So for obvious reasons, he felt very sentimental about the covers, and so, you know, it takes a lot of massaging and hand-holding and, you know, sweetness about approaching it, that, you know, we would love to give these a new face because there's a whole new generation of people who will be so excited to read these books, and they feel relevant. So luckily, in that case, the estate came around to the idea, and again, I worked with another illustrator to make those covers. And so it's hard to know, but I think, you know, there are trends in design, and when I also have a fine arts background and then worked in fashion for a while and then found my way to Parsons to study graphic design, and illustration was not the thing when I entered book design. It was photography. Mm-hmm. And there was lots of conversation about illustration, and you're nodding familiar as an illustration major. Illustration was sort of considered more the medium of children's books and young adult books. And I think that there's been this whole, over the last decade, of like a DIY movement. You know, you saw it first with knitting. Everyone in America started knitting again.
Yeah.
And sewing and crafting. And I think that paved the way for people to see illustration in a new way. And you started to see it more and more on book covers again, which it had been for decades. So that made it possible for me to start collaborating with illustrators. And because I have a fine arts background and never felt like I could make it as a fine artist, I'm often attracted to other people's work that I wish I could make myself. So this is a great way for me to collaborate.
Book covers are really in a renaissance.
They really are, yeah.
I mean, they were, I think in the 50s, they sort of hit a peak, and then...
Sure, Alvin Lustig is considered
Alvin
the king.
Lustig, and then it was Bacon for a while with all the type taking over.
Sure.
Do you know an artist named Leon Shapton? I'm sure you do.
Yes, of course, personally.
She's kind of wonderful.
Yes, she is wonderful. Yeah.
She does.
She does great personal work too, and she's also a really good writer. I don't know if you know her, right?
I have another question, just to bring it back to what's between the covers. In the course of working on these and some revisiting Flannery's work, did you come to see her fiction in a different way, or was there anything new or surprising that emerged about Flannery? Her work, or any passages or way sentences were constructed, or her imagery that emerged for you anew working on this collaboration?
Yeah, I think when, you know, that's a good question, but I think going back, and because I had read her work as an undergraduate, and I think coming back to it,
with this project in mind, you're approaching it in a very, very visual way, almost like a filmmaker would, where you're reading the work and trying to really like tease out or think about like how would we, in a book cover in one page, how do you communicate this story to the reader? How do you capture someone who's walking by like a shelf and say, you know, like, this is what this book is? And that, it's actually really challenging, because we did have a lot of initial conversations where we just tried to think about, you know, what are the themes that are really prevalent in this book, and how do we pull those out, and how do we celebrate her work, and but also not make it like one-dimensional too. And that's, I think that's like probably the most challenging bit about it, but also what was rewarding is I think it just led to a little bit deeper reading.
I because I'm challenged with this frequently. Yes.
You oh. did. Who did the design work?
I'm sorry. I want to hear what you've done new in Flannery.
Well, it's, you know, June mentioned filmmaking, because it's, with jackets it's different for book covers, because there are no images that everybody has seen. So everybody brings their own images to the books that they're reading. And you don't really want to see someone else's idea before you come to it with your own. So my old boss used to say, you know, you want to suggest the human experience on a book cover rather than show somebody's face.
Yeah,
because
like
you want
to
imagine. Yeah, why
like
is wise,
but you don't want it to be a specific man that would close down people's interpretation of the work. You want to leave it open.
We have Flannery's description of what he looked like, right? So we know that he's wearing dark glasses, but it's sort of an abstraction of her own writing. And that's really how we approached it here. And it's funny, Elizabeth, because now I've done at least maybe 200 book covers since I did these, and so sometimes it's hard for me to remember back, like what were the initial passages that drew us to how we approached this. But I do think that I saw, having read Flannery 10 years before working on this project, and the darkness in her writing had stuck with me, and that. Good old Cheery June. I knew that there was a darkness in what June creates that would marry well with what Flannery had written about. I think
that's why we kind of made some of the color choices, because the Quinkite we initially were just using was just like this black ink, and we realized, you know, like Flannery, it could get too heavy and too dark, and we needed some of those kind of vibrant colors to
lift them.
Yeah, so it wouldn't just, you know, these like dark, depressing, heavy.
Yeah, I mean, this original idea seems so silly to me now. I'm like, well, why would we even have done it? But that's, you know, this, it was a real evolution. And I think, well, I hope she'd be proud of them. They're really different from anything else, how else they were packaged. But yeah. Oh, Theo, did you have a question?
It doesn't fit where we are.
It always fits. And then we'll...
Please ask.
Just a demonstration of
Quink,
right?
So did you want
to
ask your question? Please do.
There's
no bad
question. It's such a mundane question in the context of where we are in the conversation. I don't know if I want to ask it. I was just curious. The reason being that my daughter told me she tried to do me a Christmas ornament with the stamp on it, and it didn't fit
the order
that she didn't. And then, but I hadn't really seen the stamp. I missed it the day it was, you know, released.
Yes.
But who did the work for the Postal Service?
I don't know.
I wouldn't know them anyway, but anyway, they chose an engraver or whoever does the design.
I have forgotten, but just a quick Google would bring us to
it. Actually, Lawrence Downs, who's a writer, and he's on the editorial board in the New York Times, he's a huge Flannery fan and a fan of Andalusia. And he called me to ask my opinion of the stamp when it was issued, and I shared my ideas. And he told me that Joyce Carol Oates tweeted out that it looked like Donna Reed, and clearly the artist had never read Flannery. So he wrote a very nice, sharp review of the stamp in the New York Times. And then, actually, I'll share with all y'all, he also produced a blog post for us that was even more sharp.
Yeah.
And I was advised not to run it. yeah, he was not Russian in his critique of the stamp.
My uncle did that, thank you.
Well done. Well done.
Just one more. The one that's on the screen right now is to be used not as a book cover, but it's just something that.
When I first contacted you,
yeah.
She just started.
I did like, I just started, I like made
so
like
excited.
20 of these.
It's
sorry.
So striking. The,
it is.
The
it was from the.
And the bands of the.
She would love that.
Yeah, and it's just, it's
that.
Right from the photograph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was just, as soon as we had kind of talked, Charlotte contacted me, I just, you know, I went online, I pulled all the books off our shelves of hers, and I just collected everything I could at Flannery's, and then I just sat down and started sketching. And I think this was before we decided on, like, the oval format and how we're going to do a book cover. I just thought, I'm just going to, I mean, as an artist, that's usually how I work, you know. I collect materials and then I just start working and I let my hands think through things and then I kind of process the materials. So I just made a, you know, a bunch of work that just wouldn't necessarily fit on a book cover, but but was, you know, inspired by Flannery and the peacocks.
Yeah.
I mean, how can you not
causes a lot of thinking?
Yeah.
What you mentioned is that you don't design, you usually don't really design book covers. I mean, was it challenging at all to kind of adapt to that kind of medium or
the rectangle?
No, not really. I think sometimes an artist giving like being given limits and a framework actually is a lot more liberating than just being like paint whatever you want with whatever. So I think having that kind of framework, once we kind of added and Charlotte could direct me, was actually, I don't know, I'm trying to figure what the hardest challenge was, but I don't think that the format was too challenging. And because I had Charlotte as my guy, if you had told me to design it, would have been different, but she had the designer's eye and she helped me edit and there was a lot of back and forth. So I wasn't on my own with it too.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a commercial artist in June somewhere. So if she's really comfortable with this kind of manipulation of her work, which
yeah. And I think like I as an artist I'm very excited about that. Like I love that my daughter can go into a bookstore in like 10 years from now and even, you know, when we travel and find my artwork on a book cover. Like I think as an artist like that doesn't feel like it's devaluing it. It feels like it's even more exciting to have your work live on, and especially on Flannery O'Connor's covers. Like, I feel very grateful for the opportunity.
So speaking of entrepreneurial opportunities, our limited edition T-shirt features June's Portrait of Flannery, and they are almost sold out. So you can get them here, and also on our online store. Just to let you know, the show will be up through September 3rd, and there's more in here, and there's an interactive, there's a typewriter you can type on, and we have a prompt. We want people to share their thoughts about their favorite cover, and we will have a child's interactive, too.
Make your own
both
peacock.
Mothers, and they came up with a great idea. June is going to be on the front porch with a demonstration of her ink process, and so we'll also be having refreshments. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.